You're listening to audio from North Monroe Baptist Church. To find out more about the church or donate to this ministry, visit northmonroe.com.
Right after World War II, Europe, of course, was decimated. The economy was in shambles. Buildings everywhere were laying in rubble. But what you may not have realized is that there were little orphans, fatherless children all over Europe just trying to find their next meal. I read this story one time. This American GI pulled up to this makeshift bakery, and as he jumped out of his Jeep to go inside, he brushed past a little orphan boy who was standing there with his nose plastered against the window, looking at all of the delicacies inside that were so far beyond his reach. The American soldier didn't say a word. He just went in, got his stuff, walked out, and as he was walking out, he looked over at the little boy, and he said, "Hey, kid." The kid looked up, and he threw him a sack of baked goods, donuts, whatever. Little boy looked in the sack, looked up at the American GI, and in broken English said, "Hey, mister, are you God?" You know, we are never more like God than when we express it through generosity, because generosity and giving was so much a part of who God is. I mean, the whole concept of the cross was that God loved us, but he loved us too much to leave us in the lost condition that we were in. And so God so loved the world that he, what? Gave his only begotten son. And we are never more like him than when we express that through generosity. Generosity is such a beautiful and consequently an uncommon thing. But let's face it. We live in a pretty self-indulgent world. This is the me generation on steroids, what some sociologists call the nook of narcissism. We are consumed with self. And being in the church does not inoculate you to that selfish orientation, because it's natural to look out for self. It's just a part of us. And you can come and you can sit in a place like this, and that's not going to change naturally. In fact, there are many churches today who are even buying into it, and they're selling out the gospel to this idea that God really exists so that you can get everything that you ever wanted. One wag said this, "Promoting self under the guise of promoting Christ is currently so common as to excite little notice." I mean, it's in our nature, it's common. But we're not called to a common life. We're called to an uncommon life. And that means rather than feeding selfishness, we're going to have to foster generosity. Genesis 13 shows us what that looks like. So let's get our Bibles. Let's go to Genesis chapter 13. Abraham is our model. Turn on your devices, whatever it is, however you read the word. Pull it out. And let me be clear about this while you're trying to find it. Genesis 13. This is not a talk on giving. It is not my purpose to try to somehow guilt or shame you into giving more money to the church. I'm not looking for this moment where we go, you know, honey, we got to give something, you know. What I'm trying to show you is that if we are to live an uncommon life, then generosity marks every aspect of that life. It's not just something you do routinely one time, one and done, but it's something that becomes a way of life as it marks who you are. And we saw this in Abraham in Genesis 13. Now, last time we were together, if you were with us, we were looking at Genesis 12. And in Genesis 12, we see where Abraham's faith faltered. The Bible says there was a famine in the promised land. How ironic that there's a famine in the promised land. And the principle is obvious that even when we're in the middle of God's will, we're still going to go through famine experiences. Well, when Abraham ran into the famine, he started to panic. And fear took root in his mind and ultimately made its way to his heart. And he starts to move. And first he moves from where he was about 12 miles north of Jerusalem into the middle of a desert in the Negev. Of course, that can't sustain life. And so he flees from there to Egypt. Now, God had never said, "Abram, I want you to go to Egypt." He's just being driven by blind fear. And as he gets closer to the land of Egypt, a new fear kicks in. He's got this beautiful wife, Sarah. And I don't know where he came up with this, whether he heard it or whether it was just in his head, but he came up with the idea that when he came to Egypt and approached the border guards, that they would kill him and take her. So in fear, Abraham tells Sarai, his wife, tell him you're my sister. And if you've read the story before, you know, they said okay, and they took Sarah, spared Abraham, and hauled her off to Pharaoh's Playboy mansion. And Sarah became one of the harem. And Abraham was left with that. I mean, fear does such crazy things to us. I mean, here's a guy who's walking with God, and suddenly fear has so captivated his mind that he has basically sold his wife for his own safety. And now he's got to live with that because there's no possible way that he can undo what's been done. Pharaoh's got her. And every night he's got to worry and wonder about what's going to happen to her. And he stews in his own shame. But then God did the most amazing thing. He gave him grace. And the Bible says that God sent plagues, we don't know what they were, plagues into Pharaoh's home. And Pharaoh's people, I don't know who figured it out, somehow realized that their experiences were tied to Sarah. And so he brings Sarah back to Abraham and says, y'all get out of here. And he kicks Abraham out of Egypt and kicks him back to the promised land. And I really believe that when Abraham left Egypt, he left a changed man. Genesis 13, verse 1. So Abram left Egypt and traveled north into the Negev. So he's tracing his path the way he had come, along with his wife and Lot. Now look at this, and all that he owned. And remember last time we talked about, it doesn't appear that Abraham was expecting a short visit in Egypt. He brought everything with him. And that word sojourn means to live among aliens. He went to Egypt to sojourn, and obviously that's a long stay routinely. So Abraham left, and he's got everything with him, verse 2. Now watch this. Abraham was very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. Now I want to point that out because there are some people who think that it's unspiritual to be rich, and it's more spiritual to be poor. And there is this pushback against wealth in our country. Look, many of the fathers of the faith were wealthy people. It's not about wealth. It's really more about what the wealth does to you and what you do with your wealth. That's the key. Here's the key question. Do you own the wealth or does the wealth own you? It's one thing to have wealth. It's another thing for wealth to have you. Abraham had wealth, but the wealth didn't have him. Verse 3, from the Negev, they continued traveling by stages toward Bethel, and they pitched their tents between Bethel and Ai. That's right where he used to live, and they where they had camped before. Verse 4, this was the same place where Abram had built the altar, and there he worshiped, and I'm reading this in the New Living. Excuse me. I'm reading it in the New Living because it's more readable. But they kind of missed that word there. The word doesn't mean he worshiped the Lord there. It means he called out to the Lord there. If you're reading in the New American Standard, you'll see that. And that word called out can mean worship. It can refer to prayer, but more often it refers to proclamation. He wasn't just living a quiet faith, sort of hiding himself under the bushel, but he was proclaiming the truth of the Lord in that place. Ray Stedman made an interesting point about Abraham. He said he was a man who lived in a tent and built an altar. I love this. Stedman said, we can identify pilgrims by two invariable symbols, a tent and an altar. Not that such people actually live in tents, but their whole outlook is that of one who lives in a tent. They hold material things loosely and are conscious of the fleeting values of what the world thinks important. There is a discontent with what the earth offers and a hunger for something more. This is the tent. The second characteristic is the altar, the place of self-judgment where true worship is found. It means having a low opinion of one's own abilities and a high opinion of God's. It's an awareness of the constant need of cleansing and a dependence upon a power greater than self. I mean, isn't that a beautiful expression? And I believe God calls us to be people of the tent and the altar. That we live this transient vagabond life where we don't cling to things. We hold things loosely. And then we constantly are aware of what's really important and who's really important. But no sooner had Abraham returned to the altar than new problems emerged. This time, of all places, from a positive experience. Watch this. Verse 5. Lot, now that's his nephew, remember? Lot's father died, Abraham's brother. Abraham took Lot in, raised him as a son. Lot, who was traveling with Abram, had also become very wealthy with flocks and sheep and goats, herds of cattle, many tents. But the land could not support both Abram and Lot with all their flocks and herds living so close together. Now, look, so disputes broke out between the herdsmen of Abram and Lot. Parenthetical. At that time, Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land. So they're so prosperous that the prosperity produces conflict, which, by the way, it usually does. Everyone thinks if I could just strike it rich, win the lottery, hit it big, all my problems and all the conflict would be over. Truth of the matter is, prosperity produces conflict. And in this case, between the shepherds. The shepherds of Abraham were struggling with the shepherds of Lot because they were taking too long at the well. They were probably running their sheep too slow in the fast lane, you know. You've heard of road rage. This is trail rage. Same thing, only slower. And they're at it, man. They're getting it, and they're mad, and they're griping, and they're saying ugly words and making terrible hand signs and all the stuff that goes with that. And clearly it's time to split up. But who gets to say who gets what land? Who gets to say who takes their retinue and entourage and takes which land? Because obviously all of the land is not equal. Now, what's the common way? Well, the common way is that the older, the bigger, the stronger, the more powerful has first choice. He gets to say. So the rich get richer, the strong get stronger, the best get better. That's the common way. It's like that old Peanuts cartoon where Linus is watching the television and Lucy, his big sister, walks in and says, change the channel. And Linus says, what makes you think you can walk in here and take over? These five fingers, says Lucy. Individually, they're nothing. But when I curl them together like this into a single unit, they form a weapon that is terrible to behold. Linus says, which channel do you want? And then turning away, he looks at his fingers and says, why can't you guys get organized like that? I love that. The strong get to decide, don't they? That was true in my life growing up. You know, I was the youngest of three boys. And if I ever got my way, it's because I was just more persuasive. And oftentimes when the choice was made, the first came in first and the last came in last. And I was last. I never forget Ben and I would go together, go in halvesies and buy a candy bar or something. And invariably, my older brother always broke the candy bar, right? You're the oldest, you control the candy bar break. And so he would break it, and obviously they never break equally, and so they're uneven. And I would go, I get the big piece. And Ben goes, no. He was always so patient. No, we got to even them up. He'd bite it off. And he'd go, yeah, that looks about right. And he'd hand it to me. And you know what's so embarrassing? I never really figured it out. And one day I'm driving along like 20 years later. I'm like 30-something years old. I'm going, wait a minute. That wasn't fair. Man. Human nature says the strongest win. The first goes first. But what did Jesus say? He said the first goes last. So let's talk about the uncommon way. Obviously, Abraham should have had first choice. He was the oldest. Anything Lot had was because Abraham had made sure he had gotten it. But watch what Abraham does. Because remember, Abraham's not common. He's uncommon. And he's our model. Verse 8. Finally, Abraham said to Lot, let's not allow this conflict to come between us or our herdsmen. Hey, now look, that's uncommon right there, isn't it? What would normally have happened? Abraham called Lot in and says, Lot, get control of your herdsmen. I've about had a belly full of this. I've done you a service by letting you live with me. I've helped you every step of the way. And this is how you repay my gratitude, my generosity. I mean, Lot, what's wrong with you? Get your guys and get them out of here. That's not what Abraham said. He said, let's not have conflict come between us or our herdsmen. After all, we're close relatives. We're family, brother. The whole countryside's open to you. Now watch what he does. Take your choice of any section of the land you want and we'll separate. If you want the land on the left, then I'll take the land on the right. If you prefer the land on the right, then I'll go left. And predictably, Lot took the better land. Verse 10, Lot took a long, notice that circle, that took a long look. Lot says, I gotta figure this out. So he brings in the surveyors. He makes sure, you know. He's like, you know, you're cooking steaks and Lot's the guy hanging over the grill measuring them, wanting to weigh which one's the biggest and the perfect. You know what I'm saying? I mean, when the boys were young at our house, this is how natural things were, how common. When we had fried shrimp, we had to count the shrimp. Did y'all have to do that? And Lot's a shrimp counter. He takes a long look. He calls in a surveyor. He wants to make sure he gets the very best. At the fertile plains of the Jordan Valley in the direction of Zoar, the whole area was well watered everywhere, like the gardens of the Lord or the beautiful land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, which is a note there that Lot took the best and lost it all. Lot chose for himself the whole Jordan Valley to the east of them. He went there with his flocks and servants and parted company with his uncle Abram. Let me just ask you, put yourself into Abraham's sandals. Slide into his spot. How would you have made that choice? I mean, would you give the best and settle for what was left, or would you have taken the best? It was in your power to do that. Here's what we need to understand. Selfishness is common. Generosity is uncommon. And if you want to live an uncommon life, then you have to cultivate generosity. What does that feel like? Let me give you three quick principles and I'm done. First, uncommon generosity is a trust thing. You might be thinking like me, I know a lot of people that would do what Abraham would do. Well, maybe you don't, but let me add two caveats to this to kind of help you understand it. You know, there's a theological principle when you approach the scripture, the Germans called it the Sitzenleben. It was the German term. It means setting in life. And what it means is when we read the Bible is a very economic book. It doesn't waste words. It doesn't delve all the time into the feelings involved. It simply says Abraham went to Egypt. Abraham came out of Egypt. They had conflict. They separated. It doesn't tell you how they felt. Why did Abraham go to Egypt? Well, we've already established that. Because he was so full of fear because there was a famine in his land. And fear had driven him out of the will of God. For all we know, and here's the first caveat, that famine has not changed. There's still a famine. I mean, this story occurs right after he comes back. We don't know that the famine was over. And do you, as a man dependent on grazing land, take the less fertile land in a famine? Second thing is, it wasn't just about Abram. He had a lot of people counting on him. And I find it interesting that this episode occurs right after he got back from Egypt. We really aren't sure how long. Was there any time period between coming out of Egypt and this conflict? We don't know. But God chose to make this the next story in his book. And I think the timing is intentional. Fear drove Abraham to Egypt. And this problem with the distribution asked the question, Abraham, are you still afraid, or will you trust me to take care of you? If you trust me to take care of you, then let Lot pick first and see what I will do. And that's what Abraham did. And God took care of him. Look at verse 12 through 17. So Abram settled in the land of Canaan, and Lot moved his tents to a place near Sodom and settled among the cities of the plain. But now, notice this little note. But the people of the area were extremely wicked and constantly sinned against the Lord. And that would come back on Lot. After Lot had gone, the Lord said to Abram, now watch what God does. Look as far as you can in every direction, north and south, east and west. I'm giving all this land as far as you can see to you and your descendants as a permanent possession. And look, that's permanent. That hasn't changed, folks. We're at 2019. That permanent possession of the Jewish land, still in place. And I will give you so many descendants, he hadn't even had a kid yet, that like the dust of the earth, they cannot be counted. Go and walk through the land in every direction, for I'm giving it to you. Abraham trusted God, and consequently, he walked in God's protection and provision. It's really about trust. It comes down to this. Selfishness is a lack of faith. Did you hear that? Selfishness is a lack of faith. I have to take care of myself. I have to get the best. I need the first, because if I don't, nobody else will. I don't really believe. I mean, I talk about believing, but at the end of the day, when the pressure's on, I don't really believe that God has my best interest at heart, so I've got to be the one to do that. Generosity is an expression of faith. And by the way, this was the key to Abraham's uncommon life. He was a man of faith, man. When God said it, when God spoke it, Abraham did it. And he walked by faith. And in this case, he said, I'm going to give what I can't afford to give and trust that you will take care of me. Generosity is a trust thing. Secondly, generosity is a grateful thing. I mean, Abraham had just had a life-changing, traumatic experience in losing Sarah to Pharaoh. And God had supernaturally returned her to him. And after that, I think he was changed. I think he was changed. You know what? Sometimes we take for granted what we have until we lose it. And Abraham, man, he had lost Sarah. She was gone. His life path, his life plan was gone. And there was no getting it back. And then God supernaturally gave it back. That changed him. Look back at verse 4. Abraham went back to the altar and called on the name of the Lord. He worshiped and proclaimed. He was back. He was changed. And I think when Abraham let Lot decide, I think he was saying, God, I'm so grateful for my life back. I don't care who gets the bigger or better share. Let Lot have it. Who cares? When you are filled with the gratitude of God, these little things, man, they just don't matter anymore. Because here's the thing. When you truly appreciate grace, you spend the rest of your life trying to find a way to say thank you. I came across this story years ago. At first, I thought it was one of these preacher stories, you know. But then I checked it out. True story. Back in the 1960s, this fellow named Eddie would walk on the beach in Florida, near Coral Gables, Florida, every morning carrying a bucket of fish and shrimp. Brand new fresh fish, brand new perfect shrimp, not the old rotten stuff. And he'd walk along, and as he'd walk, every so often he'd put his bucket down and he would toss some of that perfect, beautiful shrimp into the air, and the seagulls and the seabirds would, you know, devour it. And people passing by, not knowing Eddie, thought, what a crazy old loon, man, giving up that expensive shrimp for those sorry birds. But they didn't know the story. And I looked it up and read about it, and it's a true story. You see, in 1942, middle of World War II, Eddie's plane went down in the South Pacific. He was 52 years old when his plane hit the water. And the crew of that plane climbed into the life rafts, and they were in the water for 24 days. In fact, until Zamperini from the Unbreakable story, until his episode, that was the record for a crew of men surviving in rafts, 24 days. After 3 days, they ran out of water, I mean out of food. After 8 days, they were desperate. Eddie led his little raft in a prayer meeting. And then he laid down in the front of the raft and just kind of crossed his hands over his chest and closed his eyes. And as he's laying there sort of in and out of consciousness, a seabird landed on his head. True story, landed right on his head. And kind of in the fog and haze and daze, he somehow gathered his wits. And he very carefully and slowly reached up and grabbed that bird. And he brought him back down. They killed the bird. They ate the bird. And then they took the entrails of the bird and they used it for fish bait. And that bird kept that raft alive for 24 days. And Eddie said this about that experience. He said that the bird not only gave us strength, it gave us hope. He said, I took it as a sign from the Lord that I was going to survive. And Eddie did survive. He survived the war. He became the president of Eastern Airlines. And then in 1963, he retired and moved to Coral Gables, Florida. And every day, like clockwork, Eddie Rickenbacker, the highest ace of World War I, Congressional Medal of Honor winner, former president of Eastern Airlines, would walk the beaches of Florida with his bucket of shrimp and fish, and he would throw the shrimp in the air as a way of saying thank you to the birds for what they had done in his life. And I thought about that, and I thought, generosity is an expression of gratitude. It's a way of expressing thanks. One last thing. It's a God thing. Proverbs 14:31. Those who oppress the poor insult their maker. Wow. If you've got resources and you oppress the poor, you insult your maker. But watch this. But helping the poor honors him. Generosity honors the Lord. And that's what the world needs to see. That's what's uncommon. Let me back up one last time, okay? Bear with me. You've been so patient. Bear with me one more time. Look back at verse 7. There's a parenthesis there. It says, at that time, the Canaanites and Perizzites were living in the land. Do you see that? Now, the Canaanites were the descendants of the Amorites. I got that. I don't know who the Perizzites were. I don't think it matters. The question is, why did it say that? That doesn't fit the story. Why is there a parenthetical aside to tell us who was there? And I thought about that, and I thought about that. Why would God tell us the Canaanites and the Perizzites were in the land at that time? And here's what I suddenly realized. God said that so that we would be aware that the false nations were watching what was happening in this family conflict. And all of a sudden I realized, you know, that faith isn't done in a vacuum. It's done in real life. Your faith is going to be seen in the way you treat people. And the way you treat people shows how you believe in God. And so right there in front of the Canaanites and the Perizzites, Abraham did the most uncommon thing. He offered generosity and gave the better land to his nephew. We are never more like God than when we live with uncommon generosity. So can I ask you, how generous are you? When someone needs a hand, will you give up your time to lend it? When someone needs an ear, will you sacrifice your time to bend it? When someone needs some resources, will you open your wallet and spend it? How generous are you? We are never more like God than we express that through generosity. Maybe it's time for us to make some basic commitments. You want to do that? Let's just pray before the Lord right now. I want to ask you to make two commitments this morning. I don't think change happens without a commitment, so here's two. God, I purpose to be less selfish. God, this day forward, I just purpose to be less selfish. Father, every time I want to take the first and every time I demand the best, remind me of Abraham. Make me less selfish. And Father, I purpose right now in this place to be more generous. More generous of my time, more generous of my patience, more generous of my heart, more generous of my assets. And Father, I'm not just going to take everything that I have and spend it back on myself, but God, I'm always going to be available to meet needs. And regardless of how that shows up. And so, Father, as we live in the land of the Canaanites and the Perizzites, who are living a very natural, common life, God, help us to show them what an uncommon life looks like. Help us, Father, to be the generosity of Christ. You've given us this beautiful gift of grace. We didn't earn it. We don't deserve it. God, let us spend the rest of our days trying to find a way to say thank you for that. And open our hearts in ways they've never been opened before. And make us different. God, just call us to be different. Don't let this church be the same. Don't let us be so selfish. Make us generous, like Abraham was. God, make me generous. In Jesus' name, amen.